Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren, and this is our internet talk radio program. And yes, we are recording from Sweden's west coast. You can tune in to our radio show every Thursday and Sunday through our website, redicecreations.com. And if that isn't enough for you, well, then you definitely don't want to miss out on our subscriber section, where we have a growing archive of very interesting interviews available for you. Check out our website, redicecreations.com, for much more information about that. We also have a very active news section on the site, updated almost every day with interesting and important research material and news stories from around this planet and beyond. And today we have with us on the program Ben Fairhall from Battling the Behemoth. And if you have been following along our news for a while, you probably have come across a few of Ben's excellent postings. Mr. Fairhall has two blogs that we are going to talk more about today. One, as I said, is The Daily Behemoth, and the other, as I mentioned in the intro, is Battling the Behemoth. And I guess the easiest way is to go to ben-fairhall.blogspot.com. That is the Battling Behemoth site, and from there you'll also find links to his other blog, The Daily Behemoth. And it's always a pleasure and interesting to have a new voice with us on the program and to hear from someone who is out there following along in the wonderful craziness, as it were, that goes on around the world, and contribute their own analysis and perspective on it all. And Ben seems to be interested in a lot of different topics, everything from conspiracy to the occult, from secret societies to symbolism, history, the ancient world, rituals, and pop occulture and synchronicities, and a lot more. So it's a pleasure to have Ben with us today. So let's say welcome to the program. Very nice to have you with us. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Henrik. It's nice to be here.
Excellent. It's great to have you. And, you know, I just wanted to ask you, since I know that you are in the vicinity, I guess, of London at the time of this recording. We are having the ongoing concerts around the world, the 77. Yeah, the Live Earth SOS Global Warming event, as it were.
Yeah.
Have you been able to see something of it yet, either from the web or from the TV? I know that you guys over there in London have one of these events, right?
Yes, we have the this sort of sort of father of them all over at Wembley Stadium. Yes, with Mr. Al Gore himself in person, I believe, comparing that. So that should be fun.
Ah, so he's actually there at in London.
Well, I'm not completely sure about that, but I think he is, and certainly I think he's going to be dropping in at some point.
So. Yeah, he might be flying around the globe, I guess, and visiting all the places.
Yes, which would be rather ironic, considering what the concerts are supposed to be raising awareness of, isn't it?
Yeah, that's quite funny. Yeah, we actually looked a little bit at the feeds, from Amazon, a lot of. It's interesting because it's a lot of lights, as it were, and it's a lot of conundrum in a way of this entire event. But I realize it in one sense, because it is about the raising the awareness and so forth. But anyway, it's nice to have that going on.
Sure.
One thing I also wanted to ask you a little bit about, we had the recent kind of bomb scare, I guess, over in London. What was it, last week? How are things over there?
Last Saturday,
that's right. How are things over there? Is it scary on the streets?
No, not at all. No more scary than London usually is, which, isn't particularly scary sort of around, my parts of London, which is sort of southeast, southwest London.
All right. Okay.
I think, what needs to be said about that was just how convenient it was in terms of the timing of it. I mean, it was, beautifully synchronized yet again with 7/7, of course, which is, obviously, where we are today.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
I'm
right.
I'm speaking to you right now on the glorious 7th, and I'm still here, which means my end time fears have not yet materialized.
Okay, well, that's good. Tell us about that. What was that in regards to 7/7 and your end times fear? Tell us about it.
I'm sort of kidding you there, but but certainly I've been very aware of the impending 777 celebrations, festivities, and it's quite clear that there have been things, shall we say, lined up for this period. And I personally think that the sort of staged sort of terror drill, which went off last weekend in London, you know, I think that was one of them.
Mm. Okay, and I guess even the initiation, as it were, of Gordon Brown kind of dovetails with this a bit.
Well, absolutely, it does. Of course, it does. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, sort of normally when sort of somebody new steps into the helm like that, of course, people are, you know, sort of feeling optimistic. It's a time of dreams and hope that things are going to get better, isn't it?
That's right. Sheesh.
Absolutely. So straight away, you see, so that has to be scotched. That has to be quashed.
Hmm.
So instead, what we have now is this ongoing sort of campaign of fear, which is really what you know, sort of modern day sort of post 9/11 politics really has been all about.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think that they are they successful in that regard, or is there only people who manage to, you know, break through the regular media nonsense and read a bit of their own, or do you think people are more scared now?
I don't know. I don't know whether people are more scared. Actually, my sense is that they aren't, which is a good thing. I think also increasingly people are beginning sort of to, you know, maybe wake up. Mm. You know, more generally. I mean, I think that the general sort of feeling in the country, and I think it's global as well, is that people are understanding that maybe politicians aren't necessarily our best friends after all.
That's right, that's right. Except Al Gore, then, of course.
Apart from Al Gore. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, you know...
Well,
Yeah, go ahead.
He's a sort of, you know, sort of charismatic, half-charismatic kind of character who is being, you know, sort of groomed for near-greatness.
Mm.
But I haven't got very much more to say on Al Gore.
No, we can leave him.
Yeah,
we'll let him continue with his concerts.
Yes, indeed.
Anyway, you know, I want to kind of dive in and talk a little bit about your blogs or your websites. Tell us a little about when all of this began for you, Battling the Behemoth. Tell us about the name and when it started and so forth.
The actual blog itself started now almost exactly 1 year ago, maybe 13 months now. Which is when I first obtained my laptop and PC and really had any interest in sort of, you know, internet type stuff at all or computers. I mean, I'm really not that way inclined particularly.
Right.
Hence my blog is really quite simple, fairly, a sort of non-flashy, primitive kind of stuff. It's just information. It's just what I write.
Sure. Yeah.
But
it, I mean, that's what it's all about, the content. And
it is.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about, what kind of. Tell us a few of the themes that you seem, you know, it seems like you have kind of a red thread, as it were, on your blog and that you follow.
Yes.
And what kind of sparked your interest in these subjects from the beginning? What made you continue on this road, so to speak?
Sure. That's an interesting question. I mean, that would probably, you know, take us back many years, sort of back to when I was growing up, when I was sort of studying theology later in life, which is kind of an interesting sort of arc I've taken, I suppose, going from somewhere that might be regarded as reasonably sort of academically sort of excellent into the freakish and fringe world of conspiracy.
Mm.
And how did that happen? I think fundamentally, you know, I've always been someone who regards himself as being on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's, you know, almost essential when you're dealing with conspiratorial, memes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sort of somebody who is the advertiser's wet dream, you know. Sort of generally isn't going to be interested in sort of globalist conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he or she is sort of too busy, sort of taking their Kodak moments and, having fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of fun, having fun and all those sort of things didn't really happen to me when I was growing up. And so I think naturally I was someone who was inclined sort of towards this, I suppose, sort of slightly darker view of humanity. But at the same time, I regard it as actually very optimistic. I think that we're forging something which, you know, really has a great deal of hope involved. And I think that's important, and certainly I try and emphasize that in my work.
You mentioned theology. Do you think that this have kind of also sparked your interest in looking at, you know, not only religious themes, but more ancient rituals? And even would you say that it's correct to assume that, you know, there is an idea here that many of the things that have been ongoing in the past, let's say like ritualistic behavior and religious movements and so forth, that this is, how should I say it, reenacted or playing out again in our modern world through the pop culture?
Yes, that is certainly something which I've looked at, and that's sort of several researchers have. I mean, just a couple of things which spring to mind immediately would be looking at the sort of stuff that happened around 2003 with the invasion of Iraq and so on, and and all of those historical correspondences between Saddam Hussein and sort of King Nebuchadnezzar and so on. But but, you know, sort of stuff like that I don't really want to sort of dwell on right now, if you don't mind, just because it's sort of too much detail. Now I just kind of want to talk really generally and just sort of flow in that organic way, if that's going to be possible.
Absolutely. Sounds good. You know, how about talking a little bit about your latest article? You have a fantastic one up there right now that I just linked up on our website, redasscreations.com, and that dives into a little bit about this concept about Valis. I don't know if that's pronounced correctly.
Valis. Yeah, well, okay. You know, what can I say about that apart from what's already up there, I guess?
tell us about Valis first and the connection to Philip K. Dick.
Yeah, well, it was a sort of, so far as I'm aware, it was a kind of supercomputer type encounter which he had in his Californian flat where he was living at the time. And it was a stunning and extremely frightening sort of downloading of information that just happened to him. It happened to him in a totally unwilled fashion. He wasn't expecting it. It came out of the blue. And this... you know, sort of like I say, it was a sort of radical sort of burst of stuff which he did not previously know. And if I can sort of take that back with my own research and so on, you know, I find, you know, sort of one of the reasons why I struggle talking about sort of my work is really sort of largely because, you know, so most of the stuff I do sort of comes to me, you know, very, very naturally. It comes to me sometimes in sleep, in dreams, or sometimes I might just sort of sit down, start writing, start, you know, start tapping away, start finding some connections on Google and other sites, Wikipedia and so on. And, you know, lo, it just pours out of me. So it's hard really sometimes now talking about the stuff that I write, only because in some ways I don't feel entirely responsible for it.
isn't that... And if I may, isn't that a little bit of the connection actually that you did in now your latest article talking about if you were, for instance, to tie this together with the concept of, you know, as it were, downloading information and you even bring in a little bit about, you know, the stuff, for instance, that David Icke apparently went through when he was down Peru.
Yes,
you know?
He certainly did. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean,
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I mean, something quite interesting possibly happened to me maybe 2 years ago when I really started getting involved in this stuff. I mean, having said that, I can't put my finger on what that specifically was, but, you know, I'm sort of looking back at it, I do find it strange that now my whole life is entirely consumed with you know, sort of research and this sort of field, and I expect it's probably sort of something which you can relate to.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, you brought up, among you know other things, in connection to this downloading information or whatever or what have you. And speaking about Valis, as this is a kind of communication with some, I don't know, interdimensional consciousness or other being of some kind. If we were to relate this back again, maybe to the David Icke connection, we have a lot of these themes, it seems like, running through, you know, throughout history. You know, we have encounters with, of course, you know, Crowley and his Iowas, or the, you know, the angel that
Lamb,
that's right, that appeared, you know, before him and so forth. And we have religious figures, you know, Muhammad and his, you know, archangel or whatever it was.
Absolutely.
Do you think it's about communication with some other entity, or is this something that is in you know people's own psyche that is coming to light or coming forward? What's your take on it?
I don't necessarily sort of see those two things as being mutually exclusive. I'm you know sort of not a religious person. You know, neither am I particularly interested in spirituality. You know, but nonetheless, I sort of still feel as though I'm, you know, I'm sort of coming from a place which is sort of quite unseen.
Mm.
And, you know, sort of my particular practice really simply consists of I'm sort of throwing my mind out there into the other place and just, you know, sort of seeing what sort of turns up in the nets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's something which we can all do, and I think that I think that's what our controllers, shall we say, are actually quite afraid of.
Mm.
So hence we have the education system, which teaches us these very left brain sort of methods of studying and so on, which you know really are in some ways wholly unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know. At the same time, I think it's an important foundation for you know sort of you know future research of the kind that I'm talking about. But
do you think it's a kind of a new a new field? I don't know. You know, I guess we could bring up a little bit about our friend Jake Kotze, I guess, and his kind of work. Do you think that this is a spearheading into a new area of looking at you know things in our modern world and connecting them all together? I know that even Goro Adachi does this a little bit. Do you think that is the what is happening here? You know.
Certainly I hope so. I mean, I can only really speak for myself, and I'm a sort of lone voice really out here with a PC. I have sort of very little contact with the outside world of any kind in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel what I do is important, and increasingly I can sense that there are more and more people who are also starting to feel that way, but not necessarily about my work, but about others as well, about Red Ice, about Jake's work, also about Goro, as you mentioned.
Mm.
Certainly I think there are more and more people who are starting to look at these subjects.
Definitely.
And hopefully I'm trying to convey this sort of sense of how we look at them, you know.
Mm.
And I look at some researchers who have this who still have this very sort of left brain sort of obsession with content and with rightness. And personally I think that is sort of somewhat somewhat Piscean, you might say.
Mm.
and increasingly, you know, I feel that, you know, I feel it's very important that we just use our intuition.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that all the answers, if we're sensitive, if we simply start listening, if you start paying attention and you know making those connections, I think that there's going to be a lot of information, you know, pouring out of each and every one of us.
Mm.
You know, sort of rather than being something which is you know sort of sacred. Sort of controlled by a priesthood of some kind.
Mm, yeah, I see what you mean. So, if we were to talk about, do you feel that it's difficult to validate the threads that you find, or is this more like a gut feeling that you get?
I'm glad that's an interesting question, because you know, like having said everything I have just said about using intuition and about sort of almost channeling, although that's not what I do, I must stress that. But but you know, I'm almost well. So far as I'm I'm concerned, everything I write can be corroborated in terms of facts. You know, and I think that's very important that we have that sort of sense of integrity. Some researchers in various fields, and I'm not going to name names necessarily, but some researchers are simply selling merchandise, and so constantly always have to have a new and exciting series of revelations that they offer to the audience. And that I see nothing inherently wrong with that if it's entertaining people. But you know, nonetheless, I try and stick very closely to evidence and to facts which I have found and which are, as far as I'm concerned, true, which can stand up. But at the same time, I sort of spin around with that with this very intuitive framework, which is, I suppose, you know, sort of more an expression of lyricism and poetry rather than hard, cold facts.
That's interesting you say that, poetry, because I think that also that you manage the language in a very different way. Exactly.
Now, you know, I'm pleased we're getting onto this one, only because, you know, you're talking to me. You can tell that I don't necessarily enjoy speaking and communicating with people all the time. It's not, it isn't really my forte, but, you know, words and words and language are something which I have a great deal of interest in and love for, and it's something I'm very good at. And so, you know, I can't easily talk to you about content, only because, you know, I'm very much about other things, about medium and about message, rather than necessarily sort of spinning a line. Hopefully this is starting to make sense to you in some way.
We're catching up here and trying to figure out how you work and why you write the things you do. So this is excellent stuff here. You know, one thing I also wanted to ask you a little bit about is, I know that you've been following in your recent postings story of Madeleine McCann.
Yes, I have been indeed, and it is an extremely interesting story. And actually, if you had spoken to me last week, I was actually coming to you live from Greenwich, which is where I believe so much of this story is not necessarily being orchestrated from, but you know, I can see that there are connections with Greenwich through the maritime signals, which I've been writing about at some length recently.
Yeah. I mean, have you been following the Madeleine story? Most recently, I haven't even followed it from the start. What was she kidnapped? What happened there?
Well, I mean, that's an extremely moot point, because no one really, absolutely concretely knows. But nonetheless, of course, it is being pushed very hard that that's what's happened to her. By her parents in particular, who have shown incredible strength of character, or in fact possibly something quite different. Lots of people in this country, particular on the forums and so on, have been noticing how cold these parents seem, how extremely controlled they are, and how very, very focused they are. And especially Jerry McCann, who is of course Madeleine's father, he seems very focused on his campaign, which is earning, well, let's be frank about it, him and his immediate family shitloads of dollars, my friend. A lot of money is being put into this PayPal internet campaign where you can log on and you can see the various propaganda messages that are up there, and you can get your credit card out and actually donate, and it's raking in a lot of money. And people have noticed, for example. And I don't buy this one necessarily. I'll tell you why, but let's just get on to what I'm trying to say. But anyway, lots of people have noticed that he and his wife have not publicly cried. And I think this is something which is kind of connected with the whole Princess Diana thing in this country, whereby post 1997, people, public figures, and especially people who have gone through traumas, are expected sort of to sort of, you know, sort of shed tears at every possible occasion. And I think that there are people, you know, particularly people who we might refer to as chavs here in Great Britain. That's probably not a word that you understand.
No,
but
it's
if there
not.
Are people listening in Britain, they'll be pissing themselves laughing. Now,
okay.
But, you know, but people who as I say, chavs, sort of seem to expect that everything should be, you know, so everything should be overblown and you know, melodramatic and tearful.
Mm-hmm.
Hence, you know, her parents, sort of seemingly being so stoical, have certainly attracted a great deal of suspicion. Some of it unfounded, but at the same time, I think some of it is extremely well-founded.
So what do you think is going on here? Why no tears, as it were?
Yeah, well, all I can say about this one, Henrik, if you don't mind, is it is an extremely big story. And, you know, it would be hard for me. It would not be easy or even possible sort of talk you through it step by step, you know, only because I'm still in the process of kind of getting my thoughts together on that one and actually publishing it in, you know, out there on the blog.
Sure, sure.
All I can say is that I'm hoping that people who are listening to this are people, and I know sort of some of them, you know, like definitely will be listening, who have been following my work for some time. And I've been stressing over the last month about this story and saying that if you can follow this, and if you can finally piece it together, I promise you it will blow your head off. It is a massive conspiratorial story, and I'm not convinced it will ever fully be told, but if it is going to be told, it'll be told by me.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah,
something to look forward then to, I guess, here.
I can throw out a few hints to you clearly, but I mean, if you just look at the name for one thing, that really starts, you know, throwing out a few clues, you know. And also, if you look at the kind of people who her parents have actually roped in, or possibly it's the other way around, that is the even more interesting sort of consideration we need to bear in mind. People actually involved in this story, people like Gordon Brown, you know, so people like Tony Blair, so people like the Pope. The Pope.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't get a lot bigger than that. Now, as everyone has said, everybody, you know, people have mentioned this, it has been said, but it needs to be said again. I mean, you know, hundreds of thousands of kids, of course, sadly and tragically, end up going missing every year.
That's right.
And there aren't that many parents who end up meeting, you know, sort of people of that kind of caliber.
Sure.
So quite clearly, all these forces are lining up to actually get involved. Something is afoot, isn't it? It almost stands to reason that there's something going on behind the scenes which is not right. And everybody is sensing that. It isn't only the conspiracy theorists. It's actually out there in the public. The only thing is that it's not being reported on.
So do you want to give us a hint here on what you think? I'm thinking about a few things, you know, what potentially this might be and so forth. But I'm not quite sure where you're heading with this. You mentioned, among other things, the name Madeleine. Tell us about the significance of that then.
Again, it is very difficult for me. I know this is sort of it sounds like a cop out, but. Only because, as I say, I'm still receiving information about this, and I'm not absolutely confident about speaking out on it right now. I'm sort of dealing with my impressions of the matter rather than having drawn any firm conclusions.
Right. Yeah.
All I can say is that if you think about, you know, sort of Roman Catholicism, if you think about who their central character is, and then if you think about this name Madeleine, you can start to draw some very interesting connections, especially when we are being constantly exhorted on the front covers of our tabloid press that we should be praying for Madeleine, praying to Madeleine. Can you start to see where I'm going now? If it's out there subliminally, it's this enormous enormous, I wouldn't say Catholic plot, because it isn't essentially that at all, but I think you can start to see, you know, like where I'm heading, can't you now?
Current
well,
theme.
Not, yes, absolutely. Are themes which I've looked at in my work for sure, which is very, you know, I take I take MM, I take M as simply, as it were, sort of cosmic pointers rather than anything of any greater substance than that. But nonetheless, you know, here it is again, MM.
So, I mean, there's lots of M's, as it were, out there. I know you had a posting about this a while back.
Yes, I did, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Madonna, you know, all of this still, you know, ongoing. And one thing you pointed out also, of course, was interesting that I hadn't think of earlier was that even MM, of course, becomes, 2000 in Roman numerals, you know, millennium.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have a lot of it about this.
Yeah, and you know, talking about 2000, of course, that takes us back sort of to the whole dome over there at Greenwich, which again, in this strange, I suppose, if I'm going to use a lazy shorthand, in this synchromystical way, you know, I sense all of these things as being deeply connected, and it's a pretty large canvas I'm trying to paint with my articles now over the last month and increasingly over the next two or three months. And I'm hoping I can pull it off, and I'm pretty sure I can.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I think it's a very big picture.
Yeah, it seems to be, because as you say, you know, if you're, you know, careful or you know enough, you can see the thread, I think, in a way, and kind of hints, as it were, are popping up, and you're making that more and more clear. How about this, you know, the entire thing of the goddess or the virgin itself, or Lady Liberty?
Exactly, my friend. Yes, precisely that.
That's what it's about, I guess.
Well, I am absolutely 100% convinced that is what it's about. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the you mentioned earlier the green Greenwich connection, I should say, and we have been, you know, into this whole, as you say, the maritime thing. Can we kind of, you know, first of all, tell us about some of the Greenwich connections that you did and your theories about it and so forth.
Yeah, well, that again, I mean, I'm really not a very helpful interviewee here, but I mean, all I can really talk about anything I do is just how I feel at the time. I'm awkward like that, I guess. But all I can say about Greenwich is that, it's been a place which has become a sort of obsession in my life over the last maybe 4 to 6 weeks, maybe 2 months. And I'm lucky. I mean, I live in London. I live in Southwest London, and it's really a fairly simple sort of question of getting out there over on the A2. Now, if you look at the A2, it's this ancient street that's known as Watling Street. It's a very ancient track, my friend. It is not Roman. Okay, that's an important thing to stress. It's much more ancient than the Romans. It's simply that they laid it and they extended it.
Okay.
But you know, I'm fascinated by sort of ancient tracks. Ley lines, which I guess are certainly connected, but it isn't quite as simple as, you know, sort of one being the same as the other. But and all those things, you know, I mean, I get really excited about concepts of ancient Albion.
What's that? Tell us about it.
Well, Albion is the name. Is an early name for Great Britain.
Okay.
So people, for example, you know, like Blake, for example, always sort of spoke of Great Britain as Albion. Okay. And someone else who speaks about Albion, who is also a bit of an obsession of mine at the moment, is sort of somebody called Peter Doherty.
Okay, if we were to, I'm trying to, get my head around it, as it were. Is this, do you think that this has some kind of connection with, we're talking about time, maritime signals, it's about the Greenwich thing, ley lines, all of this.
That's all good.
Is it an end of time theme running here? End of days, something like that? Something you've
end
been...
of days is a phrase that has been running around my sort of slightly warped mind for several weeks. You know, end of days is something. You know, I get up in the morning. I practically recite that. I'm inspired by those words. End of days. I think that's what we're looking at.
This is Red Eyes Radio. Again, one theme that goes through your latest articles, is the Greenwich and the maritime signals theme, and I did want to ask you a little bit about the end of time or the end of dates. First of all, how do you think that this connects with the whole Greenwich theme that you've been following? This is, you know, the 0 degree, the prime meridian, as it were.
Absolutely that. Yeah, well, that's a very important factor in the first place, because Greenwich is where time begins. And, you know, I just find it something which sort of resonates with me on a poetic level more than anything else, that here is the place where time begins. And so, you know, I feel that there's some kind of correspondence there, that if time begins here, if days start here, then I think it makes sense in some way that, you know, days symbolically only, of course. I'm not talking about a real apocalypse, because sure, I don't believe that, but I'm talking about a symbolic, changing of the guard.
Mm.
And I think that, personally, I think that Greenwich is going to be very, very significant. And I'll tell you one of the reasons why, and this is sort of fed into sort of some of the recent research which we've been doing, and also guys like Matthew Deleuze, my friend,
mm-hmm,
out there in Lancashire, has been doing.
Yeah.
2012.
Yes.
Now, of course, you know, everybody, we all know about 2012. But the important thing is that 2012 is also the year in which London is hosting the Olympics.
That's right.
Yeah. And of course, one of the important sort of venues is going to be sort of Greenwich's Dome. So if we're looking at a possible sort of suspect for the end of days, or for a, as it were, a symbolic sort of start of a new age, then clearly 2012, you know, is important. And, equally, with so much international energy being sort of sent London's way at that time, and especially on Greenwich itself, you know, I think that's also something very significant.
So this does imply, I guess, that the guys running the show are aware of this, do you think?
Yeah, I think they're highly aware. It's an interesting question. I mean, you know, only because as I get more into the occult conspiracy, which is, you know, sort of what I do primarily, and I think that's where you are as a researcher, and in terms of Red Ice, which is sort of why I like talking to you, and also why I think your site's an excellent resource, because, sort of something which keeps coming up is this sort of question of how conscious all this is.
Yeah.
And I personally believe that so much of what we're seeing, you know, like, is not necessarily consciously planned, but it's people who are unbeknowingly following an ancient archetype, an ancient blueprint, and it's something which is quite possibly hardwired into our DNA itself.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's something which we see it's something which we see all throughout the ages. It's something which we can find in holy scriptures, for example, you know, as you were mentioning earlier. And it's something equally, it seems to be something which we can find in popular culture.
Mm.
It's this concept of this very ancient but at the same time endless and timeless game, which is being played out in front of our eyes, and it was played out yesterday, and it will be played out in 2012 and beyond. It's this sense that actually all of us, everything that is in some way interacting with higher intelligence, that life is itself a close encounter of the third kind.
That's nice. I like that. Yeah. Do you think that this is again, then, is this a form of you mentioned that, you know, a new age in that sense, but is it a kind of Aquarian initiation, and at the same time we see the collapse maybe of the old, hence the very
Yes, I think it is going to be a collapse. I mean, I'm sort of not somebody who who talks about the end of the world as such. But nonetheless, I think that we, in our ordinary workaday sort of physical selves, are possibly going to be in for some pretty rough times. But if I could say that, not necessarily here in Great Britain, and I don't think in Northern Europe, in Scandinavia and so on either necessarily. I think there are going to be some cataclysms elsewhere, but you know, I can't speculate on exactly what form they will take.
Sure.
I think nuclear exchange looks fairly likely, but
really?
At the same time, you know, sort of people in the conspiracy field have been talking that up now for, well, for at least 2 years, which is how long I've been involved in it.
And of course,
and quite possibly for, you know, sort of, you know, many, many years longer than that, I think.
Exactly. But, that what my point there has been going on since the entire Cold War thing has been running. And then we have the Iran thing coming up here now, it seems like. But in a way, it also feels that actually nothing big is happening on that scene as far, you know, at least not yet. And you know, I'm thankful for that, of course.
Well, I'm thankful for that. I'm incredibly thankful. And you know, obviously, I hope and I don't literally pray, but I hope and pray that it stays that way. So we were talking, about 2012, about cataclysms, about this sense of the changing of the guard, as I call it, things shifting.
If I may ask, what is Britain's part in this then, considering that they have the Olympics, as you say, 2012, they have the. Greenwich Meridian. What's Britain's part?
Indeed, and of course many other ancient sites. And of course, ancient sites are not unique, sort of to Albion. But I'm primarily interested in the ones here. It's a hard one to say. Apart from, I get the sense it's Great Britain who are calling the shots. And I think, you know, I think. Okay, you know, something I was going to, you know, something which you've just reminded me of, which is a very important point in my opinion. Now, all this talk about this new age, about the age of Aquarius, I mean, I'm not coming at you, as I hope you can understand, you know, from a new age perspective.
I
think about, you know, sort of some of the stuff that your regular correspondent, Michael Tsarian, has to say about the new age. And, you know, he says it a lot better than me, and I wholeheartedly, you know, echo a lot of that stuff. Sort of so much that's out there, and I hopefully, I'm not just telling you here, but I'm telling everyone listening, but there's, you know, sort of so much that's out there in that marketplace of spiritual ideas is a scam. In fact, it's not only a scam, but it's actually, in my opinion, quite dangerous. I mean, on the surface, and I think this is the sort of, you know, saddest and sort of evilest fact of all. But, you know, on the surface, sort of New Age spirituality seems, you know, entirely separate from the old fashioned so-called prison religions of Islam and Christianity, Hinduism, etc. And yet, of course, as anybody who's been inside Connect, you know, sort of might, you know, tell you, it's almost exactly the same kind of concepts and structures which are in place there as well.
I see what you mean.
So one of the most important changes, if it's going to happen, it is not necessarily about 2012. And again, this is all intuitive. I have this is not fact, but this is my take on it. But one of the things we have to do is actually get rid of this, of all sense of externally imposed structures, all of them. And that includes even conspiratorial structures. In some cases, if they no longer fit the bill. And it's this extremely sort of radical like reimagining of all notions of authority. And we come to understand that the only authority that's worth its salt is our own, is ourselves. We are our own gurus.
I totally agree with that, you know. Definitely. I mean,
if I can just sort of just wax on a little bit longer. But, you know, earlier. I was talking about being the outsider in life. And, you know, it's something that, in a sense, I've struggled with. But And even now, I'm still looking for a scene. You know, I'm looking for some, I'm looking for involvement. But at the same time, I know that, you know, I think I've been led here out onto the fringes for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, even though it, in some ways it's, you know, I find it quite a hard path which I'm walking.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, it gives me a certain integrity which is absolutely unshakable. You know, I'm speaking to you sort of simply as myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not speaking to you in any other, I'm sort of representing any other structure, any other sort of any other format apart from that.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Definitely. I see what you mean. I mean, and I totally agree with that. I mean, we have been talking, as you say, with Michael and others, of course, also about this, about the. You know, many people seem to be, you know, inclined towards the kind of collectivism or be a part of a group in that sense or whatever. And in a case, even the conspiracy movement or what have you is that kind of similar thing going on. And I definitely agree with you that that this is about the awakening of the individual and realizing your own part in all of this and seeing, you know, your own way and so forth. And I think that you're managed to, you know, bring out that also in your writing, as you say. And again, I want to tie this back a little bit to what you mentioned about, you know, the particular, the language that you use, for instance, you know, are you, do you have a background even in poetry or English literature, studying that and so forth?
Yes and no. I mean, I'm a frustrated rock star, like hand on heart, I will admit that.
Really?
certainly. Yeah. You know, one of my key influences when I was growing up was, Bob Dylan,
mm-hmm.
who I could talk to you about Dylan all night, you know, I mean, his language, his style, his creativity, you know, like still inspires me today.
Sure.
You know, apart from anything else, I love his voice. You know, I love everything he does with his instruments.
Mm.
He's a talent. I don't think anybody would seriously sort of doubt that he has talent.
Mm.
And, you know, I've seen him in concert several times. I often wax lyrical about Dylan because he's unquestionably one of the people who actually brought us where we are now. And I mean in terms of ushering in an aeon. His role in this unfolding was massive, is massive. I mean, if you can try and imagine what life was like in 1964, 1963, and then this fiery dynamo turned up and plugged in and created rap music right there with Subterranean Homesick Blues and many other songs, obviously many, many other songs. I mean, I love... Visions of Johanna in particular, and I could list 9 or 10 Dylan songs which are absolutely first class.
Sure.
And again, it blew people's minds, and it has not really happened since. I mean, you know, I think Jimi Hendrix also had a similar impact.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you know, I'm a big fan of Noel Gallagher. I think he's a very talented songwriter and musician,
mm-hmm.
and he was huge, but he didn't have, and he would himself admit that his he hasn't had anything like the kind of spiritual influence which sort of someone like Bob Dylan wielded. He was a one-off, and I think in decades to come, he will be regarded, you know, sort of certainly in the fringe world in which I operate. I think he will be regarded as a kind of avatar.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And I personally believe that. Yeah.
Are these guys the modern day prophets in a way?
Yeah, you know, I mean, people have described Bob Dylan as being a prophet, and it seems now embarrassing only because when he's tried to, you know, live out that role in a conscious way, it hasn't worked. But if we can track back 30, 40 years ago, back to the period of Blonde on Blonde and to, Highway 60, Highway, um, that that one. Mm-hmm. He was being a prophet sort of through using language in a way which was entirely sort of non-biblical and sort of totally non-conformist in terms of how we expect a prophet sort of might behave.
Sure.
If you're kind of with me there on that point.
I haven't. I'm sad to say that I'm one of those guys who actually haven't dived into that much of Bob Dylan's material.
Yeah, well, I talk about him all the time, but what you were talking about there with asking me about my background in language, it's quite a funny story really, but. Sort of writing I've always done, but I've always done it very unsuccessfully. And it's only really been in the last 2 years since it might even be less than that. It might be in the last 6 weeks. I don't know. But, it's only been since I found, my subject matter.
Yeah.
Have I been able to really... express myself as a writer in that fashion.
I see what you're saying. I guess that when the subject matter comes at hand, the writing comes more easily, I guess,
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly, that's what I'm trying to say.
Ben, one other thing I did want to talk a little bit about with you here today is the aspect of crop circles. This is also this is something that comes up again, either through images in your postings or through that you're relating to the latest ones or whatever.
I am, my friend. If I can talk to you briefly about the crop circle, which came up on the 13th of April 2007. Now this is very early for a major crop circle to appear. Ordinarily, early May might be regarded as the start of the season, but we have one April the 13th earlier this year. And if you heard my podcast with Greg there, I actually mentioned some of the some of the correspondences noticed in this crop circle. Friday the 13th, I mentioned that fact. Also 2007, and there are some very important anniversaries and some very important dates which were centered around this time in this year and also looking back in the past. And one of the things I mentioned, and it's 90 years ago this year, and it's just passed because it was in, let me get this right, it was in May, and it was May the 13th 1917. And of course that was the all-important visitations over there in Portugal. Do you remember?
Are you talking about the Fatima? Yeah, of course. Yeah. Definitely. Yep.
Yeah. Now, here's a very interesting thing because, I sort of spoke about Fatima. I really just picked that one out of the ether almost. I mean, I hadn't planned to mention it.
Yeah.
It was something which I actually thought about, as I was discussing it with Greg.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned Fatima, and I mentioned this fact of the important 90th anniversary. And of course, if you've been following the news, that was an extremely important event in the story of Madeleine McCann. Her parents actually visited that shrine out there in Fatima. I think it was even on the 90th anniversary, but it was certainly very close to it. And I couldn't believe how, from having looked at this crop circle, and it was simply through the inspiration I sort of drew from that crop circle that I was in some sort of prophetic way right on the money in terms of actually, what was going to unfold as a result.
Remind us again on a description on how it looked. I can't remember it now. What was the motive on the crop circle?
Yeah, it was actually very, very simple, but nonetheless it had a certain energy which I associate with crop circles, which are, I mean, I don't like to use the words real or fake, because you know, I find that a very unhelpful sort of dichotomy. But you know, nonetheless, it had something about it which I immediately resonated with. And it, yeah, if I can describe it, it was just a sort of simple circle. It was just a circle which had been broken up so almost like a rainbow into sort of seven different arcs, if you're kind of with me there. So, so seven, you know, sort of curving lines just going from from, you know, right to left, left to right, whatever, on the circle.
Yeah.
It was extremely simple, but I was struck by the fact that it was very early. It was beautiful in its own way, and it had this certain energy which I can't, you know, completely describe to you. I can only try and convey it. So I just, you know, like sort of started looking at some of the at the you know, natural correspondences which kind of flowed from that. You know, Friday the 13th, 1307, which is 700 years this year. You know, 1307, of course, you know, sort of Friday the 13th. It's Knights Templar.
Templar purge,
and of course, you know, sort of Knights Templar were very interested in Mary.
That's right.
And like 1917, on sort of May the 13th, and actually continuing, you know, right up until October the 13th, and it was on the 13th of every month. You know, sort of stuff happened over there in Portugal. You know, really major visitations which happened there. Also, the other one which we have to remember is 1947, okay, of course, which, and let's get that right. What is that? 60 years ago, that's, you know, 60 years ago. Now, that's, of course, Roswell. Plus, it's everything else that happened in 1947, because there is a raft of really significant, you know, dates, anniversaries, stuff that happened in 1947, which are, you know, vitally important in you know, sort of, you know, fully understanding what's happening right now.
Yeah, I totally agree. By the way, have you seen the, is it David Flynn, the lecture by David Flynn, where he connects 1947 with 2012? Have you seen that?
Yeah, well, actually, no, I haven't. But from the sound of things, he's totally, you know, sort of up my street, as it were, in terms of where I'm going with it. But if I can just sort of throw in sort of something else, which I hadn't thought of at the time when I mentioned it to Greg, and also when I was, you know, mentioning this on the blog, but also 1967, and it was the 1st of June 1967, so it's just passed. It was the 40th anniversary of Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
And what's the significance of that then?
Well, I mean, you know, I was talking about Dylan as being a kind of avatar of these new energies, which were very extremely potent as they were being introduced in the 1960s.
Sure, sure.
And I think that he, you know, certainly I think that he was the sort of, you know, shining star of that particular group. But at the same time, we had John Lennon and possibly, I don't rule out, George Harrison. You know, so Paul McCartney, I'm afraid I'm not a fan of. I'm not a fan of Mr. McCartney at all, but but you know, sort of certainly, you know, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band sort of was and is a sort of instrumental, you know, sort of piece of modern art.
Sure, sure.
And you know, I think, and also in '67, it was the 40-day war over there in Israel and so on, and that is also very important in terms of what's happening in the Middle East right now. And possibly, my friend, it's not only important what's happened now, but it might even stretch back for a lot longer. Stretch back centuries, because again, it's part of the ancient blueprint that I'm talking about.
So
it's all part of this ancient archetype.
Very interesting. Do you want to speculate on the significance itself on Jerusalem? Why
I've been there.
You have?
I've been there, yes. And, you know, I'm talking to you now. As you can tell, I'm a fairly nervous character. I'll tell you something, my friend. I was shitting bricks all the time I was over there.
Really?
You know, yes, I was highly paranoid. I mean, I was paranoid on the plane. I was paranoid when I got off the plane. I was paranoid on the airport. And I didn't stop getting paranoid until I got back to Gatwick. Yeah. I mean, it's the most... it's well, actually, the only place I wasn't paranoid was actually right there in the old city, which is beautiful. Mm-hmm. And it is. And I could understand. I was standing there on Temple Mount, my friend, and I had, and I was in tears. It was the most beautiful experience of Earth energies that I've ever had. It is. It was a feeling of the presence of God.
Really?
But yes. Huh. But of course, I don't necessarily say it was I don't say it was one God rather than another.
But sure, sure, yeah.
It was an incredible thing. I don't think I'll ever forget that moment. Yeah, and you know, ordinarily, you see, I mean, I don't I don't really leave South London generally, if I can possibly help it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so getting on a plane and going out to Israel was actually a really brave thing for me to do.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting?
And you know, sort of being in Jerusalem. Mm. Being in Jerusalem was quite awesome.
Hmm.
And it's something which I'm unlikely to do again, only because I don't really want to go through these sort of same kind of hoops which you have to pass to actually get through the customs at the airports. And of course I understand why they do it, but I don't like it.
What drew you to that particular place then?
I mean, I can only imagine that it was something which other people arranged for me, because I don't really have the skills to sort of arrange something like that. Mm. It literally happened spontaneously. So all I can imagine was that in some way I was being guided there. I was being led to go to Jerusalem and to experience something there, mm-hmm. you know, sort of something of the energy, you know, something that was quickening in me, like as a result of being there. I really don't know. But, but as I say, I'm glad I've been, and I feel it was quite significant.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, a lot of fighting has been taking place, obviously, on this place.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, having friends who are Israeli, I mean, I'm, fighting always goes on there, always. It's not something that's happening now as a result of 2007 or, you know, sure. changing energies or anything like that necessarily. Sure. It's been happening for a freaking long time.
That's right.
And it's always happening there.
Hmm.
Which is in itself, you know, very strange. I mean, it's a stretch of land, sort of like any other in some ways.
Yeah.
And yet, sort of here we are, and it's been going on. It's been going on for a long old time, isn't it? That place is the umphalos. It's the navel. It's the it seems to be where sort of days start and end. Talking about Greenwich. Now, here's the point, my friend. This just reminded me of something which is really interesting. But all this talk about Greenwich 2012 and the importance of that place, well, you know, here's something which they both have in common. I'm like, out there on Temple Mount, you know, up there is that beautiful, stunning, you know, dome.
Mm, yeah.
Yes. And out there on the peninsula at Greenwich, it's certainly not a very beautiful dome. It hasn't got anything on it, but it's still nonetheless... It's there in your face. It's a giant fuck off dome.
And in regards to these places what's your take on the dome? Why have they put it up on that place? I mean, obviously, speaking of Jerusalem, we know that this is a Muslim shrine and so forth. But what about the Greenwich Dome? Why do you think they have put it up there?
Well, I think that is a very, very interesting question. And again, it's something which I'm looking into increasingly.
Sure.
And it's something which I've sort of started discovering right today, in fact. And so this is coming to you straight off the press, as it were. But how we need to understand that dome is actually in relation to its neighbour. And if you know anything about the Isle of Dogs out there in Tower Hamlets in London, of course, it's been marred in the last sort of 7 or 8 years with this extremely large obelisk.
Really?
Black obelisk. And it's called Canary Wharf.
Did you say Island of Dogs?
It's the Isle of Dogs.
Isle of Dogs.
Yeah, it's the sort of name of the sort of district out there in East London.
Okay, I see.
Yeah, it's
And a big obelisk is being built there right now.
It's been built. It's yeah, it's been standing for almost 10 years now. You know, I describe it as an obelisk. I mean, you know, so anybody else, you know, might say it's a skyscraper.
Okay, yeah. And what do you think? Are you still there, Ben?
I'm still here. Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry,
okay.
Ben.
Yeah.
I'm kind of looking at that symbolically. Here is an enormous skyscraper, and it's extremely large. I think it's one of the sort of tallest in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
It's a massive skyscraper, and so right at the top, it has a classic sort of Ben stone. It is a perfectly formed obelisk. There's no doubt about it, and it's massive. It's huge, and it's sort of barely a stone's throw from this newer dome.
Mm.
And so here we have the classic. Well, I mean, it strikes me as very obvious. On the one hand, there's this giant, raging, thrusting penis, and of course, on the dome is the opposite. It's the sort of yoni. It's the female principle.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, and so I see no sort of coincidence that we have, you know, right there next to this large, thrusting sort of obelisk, so this dome, and it's something which, if you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, and this is, you know, like straight off the press as far as I'm concerned, so I've only just looked into this today, but but if you look into the Dead Sea Scrolls, and if you start sort of studying the ongoing themes in that document, if you're kind of with me there, then hopefully are you making sense with where I'm going with it all?
I think so, but do continue and we'll, you know.
Yeah, well, it's this sort of ongoing war, as it were. In the scrolls, it's expressed as the sons of darkness and the sons of light, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And if we take as our basic premise, and this is only a premise, but if we take the idea that that the kind of religion which we see written in the Dead Sea Scrolls is sort of something of the Serpent Rouge, of the kind of secret teachings which many of our leaders and so on have still followed, right? Then I think it makes perfect sense that here it, you know, sort of right here at 0 degrees, is a quintessential expression of that conflict.
Interesting. I'm thinking also about very simple connection, of course, with Washington D.C. again, with a big obelisk,
yes,
you know, Washington Monument, you know,
precisely, and of course at Rome right there as well.
That's right. Yeah, of course.
St. Peter's, and also this huge thrusting obelisk in there. And so I see. Well, absolutely, I hadn't really thought about that before. But isn't that perfect indication of the importance of Greenwich, symbolically at least?
Yeah. But, have you in your studies about the meridians and all this, have you come across what is or I guess was more known as the time balls?
Yes, I certainly have. Yes, I have indeed. That's up there on the up there on the hill on the observatory.
Ah, it's still there, I guess. Yeah.
Oh, it's still there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's still there, and it still works every sort of noon GMT. Yes, will drop.
Oh, okay, they rise it up and then they drop it, I guess. But this has had it mainly to do with the navigation for the ships in the area to correct their time.
Yes, that's right. Yes, absolutely. That it was a kind of visual signal at the time that was necessary.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
How about this, you know, theme with the mariners then? You know, the navigators, the ancient navigators of the sea.
Yes, indeed.
Seems to be a theme that is upcoming again and again in a way, and even...
Yes, it certainly is, my friend.
Yeah.
It certainly is. Yeah. Well, you know, if I can link this in with this sort of notion of the maritime signals, and also we talk about Madeleine McCann, and I'm going to try and you know, sort of piece it together for you in a way that's just intuitive. But you know, sort of somebody on my blog actually offered this comment, because I was talking about maritime signals for a long time, or at least for a few weeks, and I didn't really know why I was banging on about this, but somebody who hopefully he'll be listening, he sort of sent me this little intuitive response. He said, well, you know what maritime is, it's, and here is the key, my friend. It's Mary time.
There you go. Exactly.
Okay, can you understand what everything I'm trying to communicate? I'm not very good at it, but but it's all there in that one phrase, Mary time. That is where we are going. And if we look at the Holy Blood and Holy Grail, and if we look at Dan Brown's sequel, you know, I'm not, it was an unofficial sequel, but that's what it was. Everything is pushing us in this way. But what we have to understand is, you know, I have a real passion for Mary and for the and for everything that that you know, so she represents. But you know, the important thing is that it shouldn't be them, if we want to call them who are setting the agenda for that. It should be us. And so all these things, all this Holy Blood nonsense, and all this sort of stuff about Madeleine McCann, which I believe is part of this, all part of pushing that feminine iconography. It was the same with Princess Diana, in a subliminal, very subtle way. Yet it's all trying to lead us. It's all trying to push us in a certain way. And the important thing is that we actually, you know, sort of take hold of our own destiny and set the agenda ourselves, rather than being shoehorned sort of down any particular sort of religious funnel. Are you kind of with me about where we're going?
Yeah, definitely. And one thing that that comes to mind here, of course, is about I wonder if it is significant, you know, in you know, what deity, so to speak, we actually worship or you know.
It is. I believe it's highly significant, and you know, and I'm very excited about this, because I am a, I am a Mary worshipper of sorts, although not in the Catholic sense. I mean, I like to think I'm a sort of true devotee of the feminine. If that means I watch a lot of porn, I don't know. But
okay.
You know, but you know, it's kind of important. It is important where we're going. And you know, I've been aware of this. I've been trying to talk about it, trying to communicate it for a long time, but I've only been able to find a symbolic language of doing it. So, for example, you know, I was talking about Britney Spears not too long ago, and lots of people read those articles, and I'm very grateful for that. And you know, I can give you a little bit of news on that, because I'm going to be publishing that series of articles quite soon, and people can, if they care to, purchase that from my site in hopefully in the next 6 months or less. So that's kind of quite an exciting development from my perspective.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just more generally, I mean, why do you think, why did you follow up on this story about Britney in the beginning?
Yeah, well, precisely. I mean, I'm trying to explain it in a way, and it was something which at the time, you see, at the time of actually beginning that investigation, I mean, I thought that it was simply a case. I mean, you know, I was, as everybody was, you know, a Freeman, who you had on your show, doing some great work on that subject, which is very inspiring for me. So I take my hat off to him there. But you know, he, you know, also got quite fired up, sort of simply by the symbolism of it.
Yeah,
it was a very extremely powerful sort of symbolic statement that was being made there with you know, obviously Britney Spears shaving off her head.
Yeah.
At the time, I thought I was going to write, you know, possibly one post about it and move on. But, but you know, more and more as I got into it, I realized that it was a kind of metaphor for precisely this kind of thing that I'm trying to communicate to you, which I cannot express in simply one sentence in a soundbite. But it was exactly a metaphor for this process. And then increasingly, you see, I sort of brought in, you know, I brought in this notion of the M.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not blaming one woman specifically, you know, I'm sort of Madonna. I mean, I admire Madonna. I think she's an infinitely better artist than Britney Spears. And I think she's a talented, I think she's a very talented businesswoman. But, you know, you know, if I can try to explain it to you here, you know, all of these idea, you know, all of these Dan Brown, Holy Blood, Holy Grail stuff, all of these kind of false ideas, you know, all of these, you know, like false notions of what life, you know, post 2012 ought to be about, you know, sort of she, I tried to, you know, if I can try to explain it, that she was my symbol for that process, that she was my metaphor, M. And we, our naked humanity, you know, are in some ways Britney Spears.
Interesting.
Who is being overshadowed by this, you know, dark principle? Who is trying to manipulate us? Who is trying to change our belief systems? And that's what all this is about. It that's the key to all of this. It's about our belief systems. And you know, our duty is to shake that thing off. I can't express it any better than that. We have to shake Madonna off.
So this is about a, considering what Britney then went through, you know, a very dark period in a way, totally, you know, rebirthing.
Absolutely, that rebirthing is how I like to view it myself. Now, you know, I'm hoping that I'm making sense in spite of all my, you know, sort of speech defects and limitations, but no, I sense I am.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, there's so many, I totally agree. This is an interesting story. And I mean, again, we can, and another theme again about the, you know, again, this is very much about the virgin and the goddess and all of this, but.
Yes, precisely.
How about the scarlet thread or the.
The scarlet thread, my friend.
The lady in red.
The lady in red.
Tell us about it.
Thank you. Yeah, well, you know, kind of what happened with the lady in red, that was something, again, that was going back maybe 4 or 5 months ago now, that I was becoming, you know, very aware of this archetype. Not a great deal to say apart from, I mean, how did that come about? As I recall now, that was through my investigations of Roslyn Chapel.
Yeah.
And also through some of Jake Kotze's work, which was very inspirational at the time. And again, I take my hat off to him because he's done a superb work.
Indeed.
And it was the idea. And of course, it was only symbolic, only because there are lots of, you know, people who at some point in their life wear red. So it's purely a kind of sort of like symbolic pointer in the same way that the M is and MM is, you know, but nonetheless, I was tracking sort of some examples of, you know, largely famous individuals.
Scarlett Johansson being one, I guess.
Scarlett Johansson. Yeah. We had Britney Spears. We had many sort of similar type examples. And I was seeing it as a kind of metaphor for the bloodline. And again, that takes me off. I'm trying to remember myself now what I wrote about the bloodline. Sure. But that was the idea, not so much. And this is very important. This is sort of what separates me from, you know, just about every other researcher out there. And I think I submit to you that I've got it right here.
Yeah.
simply because you know, lots of researchers. You know, including you know, the authors of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and so on.
Sure.
You know, talk about blood.
Yeah.
And talk about it in this very literal sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you look at their agenda, always look deeper at what they're saying. Yes, they're beautiful ideas. I love those ideas, my friend. I get very excited about those ideas because who wouldn't? It's a beautiful. It's a wonderful, extremely complicated, you know, sort of pattern that they're weaving. But you know, if you look underneath at what their agenda is, same with Dan Brown, it's always coming back. It's always sort of leading back in you know, sort of two or three sort of particular directions. And it's actually what it's really trying to tell you is that certain people are actually inherently much better than others.
That's right.
Certain people are more are actually more king-like, you know, sort of kingly and closer to God than you.
Yeah.
And so as a result, we must listen and you know, sort of do what they say.
Yeah. I mean, this feels, in a way, almost if you look at it and bring it into a, both a political and religious context, it's very much about even, who is supposed to inherit the earth here, considering
precisely
that.
My friend.
Yeah.
Who is supposed to inherit the earth?
Yeah.
Indeed, that is what it's about. That is what it's about. And how can I put this? All of these ideas I find are helpful, and they're leading us somewhere, and they are leading us in a, all of these ideas have something of the truth in them, but it's a question of sifting through it and finding, finding something which, actually empowers us rather than, strips our power from us.
That's right. I totally agree. I want to return a little bit, talking more about the crop circles. Are you out in the field, so to speak? Anything? Are you out there looking
indeed.
At these? You are? Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, my friend Jake Kotz is sort of coming over here and spending some time with me in about 2 weeks' time. And one of the things which we're going to do, whilst we're out here, is to spend a lot of time out there in the circles.
Nice.
So, hopefully either he or I at some point, might have some information,
from out there.
Precisely.
Yeah, exactly. Do you feel, people have explained earlier when they are in these circles and so forth that there is, more energy, so to speak, energetically heightened and so forth. Have you experienced anything like this when you're out there?
Yeah, I have. How I can put it to you best, maybe. I spoke earlier about my sensations when I was up there on Temple Mount, which was a luminous experience, and certainly not. I haven't experienced anything of that intensity in the fields, but nonetheless, if you can take that down a few notches, that's how I feel in those circles. And I think in part that's because of the beautiful sort of scenery which surrounds us when we're there.
Sure.
Out there in Wiltshire, down in Albion, my friend, which is a holy county, but then equally all of Great Britain is sacred and quite possibly Israel. But
Do you know if Albion in any way is related to albino, considering all the chalk mountains and stuff that is there?
That's very interesting, and I suspect that it is. I hadn't thought about it before, but certainly many ancient sites in Great Britain are named, like Alban is very important, St. Albans and so on. I think there is something in that, certainly, this sort of connection between Albion and this whiteness.
Yeah, because I guess a few researchers have connected it with the, considering that there's a lot of crop circles in the UK and England, and especially around that area, of course. But
yeah.
Even with, of course, we have the ley lines connection and all of this. But what about Stonehenge? Have you been up there recently?
Stonehenge, I haven't been to, but the other one, sort of down there in Wiltshire. Avebury.
Avebury, okay, yeah.
Yeah, I've spent many hours, many hours in the field there. And, Silbury Hill, of course, is very nearby.
Sure.
And also West Kennet Longbarrow, which sort of ties in with my recent article about Jerry McCann, only because I opened that piece with that photo there from that crop circle that was right next door. It was right there on West Kennet Longbarrow.
Really?
And if I can fill you in on what this Longbarrow is, I suspect you know, but if anybody doesn't know, it's an ancient portal, it's an ancient doorway. How can I describe what a Longbarrow is? It's a chamber, it's an ancient Neolithic ritual, or some would say burial chamber, take your pick. And here, right next door to it, highly symbolic, extremely attractive sort of glyph, which clearly showed this sense of walking down a checkered board floor. Walking down into the doors of perception. And many people have commented on that beautiful synchronicity, that here we have this Longbarrow, which is a hole in the earth, somewhere where you go inside and it it influences your consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of right next door is this sense of the doors of perception in the field. It's such a beautiful and perfect pattern.
Mm.
I'm very excited about that crop circle. I think it's stunning, actually.
Yeah, I mean, definitely interesting looking at. I couldn't figure it out at first, kind of wondering what the heck am I looking at here. You know, I could pick out the checkerboard, as you say, but it, in a sense, it looked like almost like a hall of servers or bookshelves in a way. But some even compared it to an image down in Egypt. Don't know if it was Dendera or if it was another temple down there. I'm not sure yet, but definitely interesting stuff. Do you know if this is one of the most recent big ones? I mean, overall, do you know if the activity down there, considering regarding crop circles and so forth?
Yeah, I can tell you a little bit about sort of this season, because I've been watching it very closely. Yeah. And last season, now the interesting thing about 2006, 2007, in crop circle lore, and it's kind of it's sad in a way, but actually what we're seeing now is the kind of falling off of this phenomenon.
Really?
Yes. If you sort of track back to sort of 2003. There were some magnificent, and I mean truly magnificent, crop circles which were produced. And, you know, sort of 2006 had, one or two, you know, certainly one I'm thinking of in my mind that I have a very clear picture of, which I visited.
Mm.
You know, certainly that would compare with anything that's gone before. But, you know, so far this season, and it's starting to get a little bit late now because we're heading towards... we're heading towards mid-July, and ordinarily now we've got another 4 weeks probably left, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly nothing on the scale of the sort of back in the earlier part of this decade have we seen yet. And people have been speculating, and I think there's something in it, that actually this miracle has actually worked its particular magic and is now possibly moving on elsewhere. So I wouldn't be entirely surprised if you start seeing more crop circles over there in Northern Europe, or possibly in the United States, or somewhere other than Great Britain. I couldn't tell you. I'm not 100% sure of that, obviously, but so that's my sense, and it's certainly, I think, one that's shared by pretty much every researcher I've spoken to on the subject.
Really? Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's something to do with consciousness, these crop circles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Clearly some of them are made by man and humans and women, and I tend to think that we sort of need to get away from this sort of dichotomy which exists.
We'll continue talking with Ben in the subscriber section now, and we'll begin to speculate a little bit more about crop circles, M, and the 2012 phenomena. We'll also talk about the unconscious versus the conscious conspiracy, the RFIDing of the Glastonbury Festival and their pyramid stage, and then we'll get into some really good stuff about the reptilian connection. So do join us in the subscriber section for the excellent continuation of this interview with Ben Fairhall. Also, before we finish this segment, do check out Ben's blog. It's ben-fairhall.blogspot.com, and there you'll find links to the Daily Behemoth and much more of Ben's excellent writing. A big thanks to Fredrik for handling the audio. We will be back on Sunday again with guest Jean Matlock on the topic of ancient cultures and much, much more. Until then, take good care. This is Henrik Palmgren. The website is redicecreations.com. Welcome.
Welcome.
This is Red Eyes Radio.